Hey everybody, happy May. In my opinion, one of the best months of the year, that is May, especially in Western Pennsylvania. Nick Delius here, and where is here? Here is the Far Middle Podcast, and we find ourselves at a milestone episode, number 50, half a hundred. Who or what we dedicate episode 52 from the world of sports? So I thought through this, and you know, Mike Singletary of the Bears, he would be, of course, very fitting. But we just did the 46 defense dedication a few weeks ago, so maybe not Mike Singletary. Then I thought about David Robinson from the Naval Academy and the Spurs and the NBA, of course. Also, like Singletary, would be very fitting, but we're not going to go there either. Instead, we are going to dedicate episode 50 to a thing, and this thing is exceptionally rare in the sport of hockey, and a particular player who accomplished the rare thing that we recently lost. So that's who we're going to dedicate episode 50 to. Now, the thing in hockey that's so rare, that would be scoring 50 goals within the first 50 games of a team's season. Now, note for this to count as official, it's got to be the first 50 games for the team in a season, not straddling two seasons, and not the player's first 50 games if the player misses some of the first 50 games because of injury or whatever. And not 50 games that don't begin with the first game of the season. So it's got to be very technical in terms of how you're meeting that criteria. Now, only five players have accomplished this feat in the history of the NHL. Who was the first? Maurice Rocket Richard. He did it first with the Canadiens. Pure artist of a goal scorer, of course. He did this. He accomplished this feat in the 1940s. Gretzky, he did it three times. And amazingly, one of those three times, he needed only 42 games to hit 50 goals. That's pretty amazing. Brett Hall was the most recent to do it. He did it twice in the early 90s. And my favorite player of all time, Mario Lemieux, he did it in 46 games in the late 1980s. I remember that season well. So you look at those who've already done it. You got Rocket Richard. He was the first. Gretzky did it three times. You had Hall do it twice. And you also had Mario Lemieux. But the fifth to accomplish this feat is who I want to dedicate the 50th episode of the Far Middle Podcast and the 50 goals in the first 50 games to. And that is Mike Bossy of the Islanders dynasty in the early 1980s. He was the first one to accomplish the feat since Rocket Richard did it. And Bossy needed all 50 games to hit the 50-goal mark. In fact, he nearly needed every single minute of the first 50 games because he was scoreless the 50th game, and he needed two goals to hit 50. So he went into that last game, the 50th of the season, at 48 goals. He needed two to hit 50. He got both goals in that game with less than 5 minutes left in the game. And what was really cool to see, if you look at some of the old clips and videos of this, was Rocket Richard was at the game to congratulate Bossy, which indicates the class act that that Rocket Richard was. Now, Bossy was part of one of the best lines in the history of hockey that was on one of the greatest teams in NHL history. The Islanders, and of course, that line of Trottier, Gillies and Bossy, just an epic line of hockey players. And we lost, unfortunately, Mike Bossy a few weeks ago, which is what brought him to mind when I was thinking about 50 goals in the first 50 games. He was, in my opinion, one of the five best goal scorers ever in the history of the NHL. So who are my five greatest goal scorers? I got Bossy there. I've got Gretzky. I got Lemieux, Rocket Richard, and Alex Ovechkin. Those are my top five. So milestone episode 50 goes to 50 goals in 50 first games of a season and to commemorate the greatness of Mike Bossy. Now let's start connecting dots. Let's connect Mike Bossy, who was underappreciated and whose potential was cut short due to injury and the beatings that he took. Let's compare him to an industry in the news that suffers from the same type of problems, and that is the domestic oil and refinery industries. I've been getting a lot of questions from people asking me to speak on a reality of the oil industry in the United States that's not understood by most and almost always is misconstrued by the media. And the issue comes down to how the domestic production, the foreign imports of, and the exports of oil all work. So when you're looking at what we import from a crude oil perspective, what we're exporting, what our refineries are doing, what our domestic production is looking like, how do those all work in tandem? And people tend to think of oil as a uniform commodity, but it is far from uniform. There is light and heavy crude grades, which basically refers to fluidity. There is sweet and sour crude grades that refers to low and high sulfur contents. In crude oil, whether it's light or heavy, sweet or sour, it's going to have to typically be refined before it could end up in your vehicle. So crude oil is just basically useless without refineries. The U.S., fortunately, has over 100 refineries, and we design many of them to be able to process heavy and sour crude, particularly some of the crude characteristics that are coming from places like Canada, which means we import, the United States imports that type of oil to refine it here. And then often we'll end up exporting the refined product to other nations. So it's a national strategic strength to be able to do this. It's not a weakness, and we should desire more refineries, not less. And that also would correlate to more crude imports to refine and then ultimately either consume domestically or export. Now, light and sweet crude is the best and easiest to refine. Okay, and much of U.S. domestic oil production, fortunately, is light and sweet. And a lot of refineries outside the United States that aren't as robust as our refineries here, they can handle that U.S. light sweet crude. So we export much of it to those foreign refiners, which can handle it. In doing so, being able to do so, again, that is a national strategic strength, not a problem. We want more domestic crude production and more export of domestic crude. So if you follow logic and math and economics, you'd expect the United States energy industry to both grow domestic crude production. You'd expect to see refineries being built to handle the most challenging of crude, which is heavy and sour. And you would expect to see an importing of crude to refine and then export again. And you would expect to see us export our light sweet crude to other nations. Yet when you look at what government and the environmental movement is looking to do these days, what do you see? Almost the exact opposite. You see the push to ban export of our crude oil. You see stopping domestic drilling for crude. You see the stopping of pipelines being built to transport the crude from the oil fields to the refineries or to the export terminals. So think of something like Keystone Pipeline, which was supposed to take Canadian crude to U.S. refineries. You see the push to shut down refineries, to stop new refineries from being built. There's a push, of course, to ban the import of crude oil, and there's a prohibition for vessels to ship crude or refined products on waterways a la the Jones Act. And then finally, right, you see the force, the redirection, I'll call it, of corn, basically food, from feed and food supply to something like gasoline additive, which drives up food prices and energy costs at the same time. It's a double whammy. So essentially, when it comes to oil and gasoline, government and environmentalists, they work tirelessly to do the exact opposite things that make sense for our economy, for the free market, and for quality of life. But that should not be a shock to any of us these days. So the next time you hear someone, whether it's a talking head or whoever, spouting off on oil import this or oil export that or corporate greed babble or oil industry blabber, be skeptical and head back to the reality, to the math, to the science. So there's the could have, should have been of the oil and refinery business, and then the stark reality. And the difference is there largely because of the heavy-handedness of government, extreme environmentalism, and a disinformation campaign lack of understanding situation when it comes to the general public. This contrast between what could be under free enterprise versus some of the troubling realities of state control, it really brings me to my next dot to connect. I want to link a great American with a not-so-good American. I read a week or so ago an interview with a great American and entrepreneur, Fred Smith of FedEx. Now, he's been the CEO there forever, and he built the company into what it is over decades. He's a Marine, normal guy doing really abnormal, extraordinary things in life, all of it because of free enterprise and capitalism. Anyway, Mr. Smith made a point in this article that is absolutely true. He pointed out that the more government regulates and controls and the more government grows, the higher the level of corruption that everybody's going to experience. And Mr. Smith, I think, is echoing what the great economist Ludwig von Mises expressed in the 1940s in his book Omnipotent Government, which is an excellent book. If you haven't read it, give it a read, Omnipotent Government by Ludwig von Mises. And in America, we think of government corruption as something basically that occurs in faraway banana republics and the like, not here, right? Well, that's not true. And I speak in Precipice, the Left's campaign to destroy America, at the end of the book, in the epilogue, about how Illinois, as it grew the tentacles of government, is now subjecting its citizens to rampant corruption in government by the most powerful individuals in government. And the example that I spoke about in Precipice was the longtime Illinois House Speaker Mike Madigan. He ran the state legislature like it was his own candy store. He made special side deals with special interests, including public unions and public utilities, that cozied up to the legislature and with entities like the government-controlled public utility commissions, or PUCs. He would drive the enactment of property tax increases in the state, and then he would turn around and benefit personally from that because he ran a law firm that specialized in, you guessed it, property tax assessment appeals for the wealthy. This is Illinois. This is Chicago. This isn't Azerbaijan or San Salvador. Well, now I get to add an update to the ending of Precipice where I discuss Madigan, because after decades of this dereliction of duty and this outrageous behavior, he finally was held to account. He was caught giving a utility what it wanted on rate increases, etc., in exchange for kickbacks and jobs that required no work for his buddies. So finally, at age 79, he is out of the legislature and he's facing 22 charges for racketeering and bribery. Should have happened decades ago. At least the citizens of Illinois who were cheated by this guy will be served later instead of what must have felt like was going to be never. Let's move on to our next topical dot. I always take a bit of enjoyment seeing situations where the bureaucratic state that is supported and nurtured by the left is then imposed on those very same supporters. It is, I think, what you'd call irony. We have such a situation in that bastion of the left known as Berkeley, California. Now, California has the Environmental Quality Act, the EQA, which requires just about any new build or project in the state to undergo an environmental impact review. And that review allows courts to impose all kinds of remediation measures that will either jack up the project cost or end up killing the project altogether, all, of course, to protect the public health. Now, of course, this has been a big driver of affordable housing scarcity and high shelter costs in California, the opposites, of course, that were intended. And I discuss that again in the book Precipice. But anyway, along comes Cal Berkeley, the out-of-control leftist incubator of a university. The university wants to build new dorms. And the residents of Berkeley, the town, they don't want the new dorms to be built and the extra students that come with the dorms. So they use the Environmental Quality Act, the EQA, trump card. The court obliged the townspeople. Berkeley, the university, was told to hold up on the dorms until a full environmental impact study could be performed. And then the university threw a fit, even though I'm sure that countless professors and students in departments on campus supported the Environmental Quality Act through the years and are devout environmentalists. Now, thankfully, the leftists on the left coast were saved when the California legislature passed a statute that changes the way universities are held to the Environmental Quality Act. And by the way, the bill passed both chambers in the California legislature unanimously. So there you have it. You see universities advocate for things like the Environmental Quality Act using public good policy reasoning. And then you have the Environmental Quality Act enacted by big government, which then stifles free enterprise in the name of the public good. You see affordable housing become more scarce and more expensive for the 99%, and then wait until the same stakeholder that pushed for the Environmental Quality Act, higher education, wait till they have to be subjected to the law that it lobbied for, and watch government come to academia's rescue so that Cal Berkeley doesn't have to be burdened with the laws and that the private sector and that the individual have to be burdened with. And you think there's not deep collaboration between the environmental movement, government, and academia? Please. And oh, by the way, for all of you conservatives out there, the Environmental Quality Act, the EQA, was enacted back in 1970. Guess who was governor and signed that law? A guy named Ronald Reagan. Nobody is perfect, friends. So while Cal Berkeley provides the perfect example of rules for thee but not for me, there is something much larger at play in society today with these types of situations. And that leads us to our next conversational dot. It's how the optics, or what some call virtue signaling, is used by the cruel to create the veneer of morality. I think Elon Musk must have used that term. I'm not sure. I read online a piece recently on the dangers of virtue signaling by Scott Nelson. He's at the Austrian Economic Center. Excellent read. Look it up when you get a chance. And it might have been Dostoevsky, the writer, one of his characters, who was famous for saying, "The more I love humanity in general, the less I love man in particular." How true is that, particularly when it comes to how the left is able to use the common good and the public good, et cetera, as sneaky ways to attack and erode the individual man or woman? You see it everywhere these days with the favored policies and tactics of big government that's run by the left. We saw it with pandemic policies. Mask mandates are a good example. They physically, literally took away a person's individuality by mandating masks, all for public safety, even though we all sense masks did nothing to prevent the pandemic spread. We saw it with pandemic policies with the draconian state-mandated economic and social shutdowns. Again, all to protect the public for the common good, even though an honest assessment shows much more harm was done than good to people and businesses across all kinds of different demographics. The cure ended up being way worse than the disease. And then you also see it with climate change policies far and wide, global to the local, that are taking away personal decision-making and replacing it with the bureaucrat making decisions for us, coupled with a heavy and steady dose of higher cost and increased scarcity. All of it, again, to save mankind and the planet, even though the math of these policies inform us that in many instances, carbon intensity increases, atmospheric CO2 is going to elevate, and the adversaries of democratic republics are going to thrive. And that lands us on our next topic, which in many ways is the most damaging example of this phenomenon. Whenever the bureaucrat or the leftist starts calling on the common good or the public interest, it usually is going to be accompanied with aligning themselves with what that brilliant economist Thomas Sowell refers to as the side of the angels of the moment. I love that phraseology, the side of the angels of the moment. Well, one such angel of the moment of big government and the left is the need to fund more and pump more taxpayer money into major public education systems across the nation. The same ones, of course, that are failing kids and parents in underserved communities. And this endless subsidy of a broken education model continues when it comes to our largest public school districts, the money pit, of course, being justified on the greater societal good. But everyone, right, except those blinded by extreme ideology, understand all that, you know, I'm using air quotes here, all that investment in education isn't, in fact, a subsidy for various special interests, namely public unions, and that our kids and neighbors in these nation's most underserved communities are not being taught to read and write, thus they're going to be assigned to unrealized potential in their lives. It's criminal. The whole of government and the left have tricked us into thinking public teachers' unions in these large districts are Thomas Sowell's angels of the moment. They are quite the opposite, and you don't need to look any further than math, science, reading, and English proficiency levels for the students in these districts. And I think we spoke about that. In fact, I know we did in a prior episode of The Far Middle. But if you do look past the abysmal proficiency scores of students, you're going to see something even more sinister. That's how funding of education has become nothing more than a smokescreen to fund public unions to protect their monopoly and to subsidize their various campaigns. One campaign, of course, being to destroy charter schools that are blowing away public unions and public schools on school proficiency and aptitude scores. And public teachers' unions hate charter schools, not because charter schools are failing, but because they are succeeding. Success, you see, is a threat that needs to be destroyed, proving that our largest public teachers' unions don't care as much about kids or parents or taxpayers or education as much as they do about more power, more money, and more influence. And I don't want to confuse, and I go on the record saying this many times, I don't want to confuse teachers with the public teachers' unions. Two distinct, two very different things. The latter is using the former to gain more power. The latter says it's there to serve the teacher, but in reality, the public union is there to serve itself at the expense of the motivated teacher. Now, I've mentioned it before, but it's worth saying again. A huge benefit to our nation would be to require the collective bargaining agreements with public unions, not private unions, have a no-strike clause attached to them and set clear performance metrics that link pay for performance. Think of it this way. If kids in our schools can't read, write, or do math, that's a breach of contract in the social compact between parents and taxpayers on one side and the public school systems on the other side. You know, speaking of social contracts, it's not just between public unions like teachers' unions and the taxpayer or parent or student. It's also the ultimate social contract is between government and its citizens, right? The citizenry. And oftentimes the level of service that you get for what you're paying for via taxes is far from what's desired. Now, the White House, I saw, is looking to address this, and the Biden administration is rolling out a program. And the program is looking to federal agencies, trying to make them more user-friendly. Boy, I read this and I said, I got to read on. This is only going to end in a dumpster fire. It's inevitable. But the Office of Management and Budget, so OMB, right, is looking at five life experiences. That's what they're calling them, that they're going to try to, you know, research, map out, understand to figure out how people want their experience to be better or different from what the actual experience is. So what are the five life experiences? They're going to look at approaching retirement. So I guess that deals with like Social Security, et cetera. I'm recovering from a disaster, moving from active military duty to civilian life, undergoing birth and early childhood for low-income mothers and children, and facing a financial shock and becoming newly eligible for support programs, like I guess unemployment. So these are the five things that people, that they've tagged as these life experiences that people go through, and I try to figure out how the overall customer experience is with respect to them. And I saw a quote here from, I guess, OMB, but it said, quote, "The idea is that we'll have this set of insights from the American public that include the priority pain points that we need to start ticking off," end quote. So I saw that priority pain points, and I envisioned, you know, the government's the doctor, and you're the patient as the taxpayer, and you go into the doctor's office and the doctor says, "Hey, where's your pain points at? And how often does it hurt?" My answer would be everywhere, all the time when it comes to dealing with government. I can't wait to see, who knows how many years down the road this will take, but I can't wait to see what the findings of this study and the results of this study end up being. And don't be surprised when government is assessing what pain points are and what pain thresholds should be. They're going to be very different perceptions and answers than what you as a taxpayer or a citizen would perceive as a pain point and the adequate threshold of pain. And I think you're seeing an example of this in play when it comes to how the Biden administration is dealing with sanctions, actions, et cetera, against Russia when it comes to Russia's war in the Ukraine. Again, a lot of theatrics, a lot of hollow gesturing, not a lot of substantive action, at least from my perspective that I'm seeing. And the most recent example of this, I saw about 2 weeks ago, there was a G20 meeting of central bankers. I forget where the location was, but we had our Secretary of the Treasury, Janet Yellen, that was in attendance, and she decided that when, I guess it was the Russian finance minister began to speak, this was a remote meeting, he was speaking remotely for the meeting, Dr. Yellen was in person. When he started to deliver his comments, she stood up and walked out of the G20 in protest. And just how the mainstream media was applauding this bold action and standing up to Russian aggression, et cetera, et cetera. Look, ladies and gentlemen, that's theatrics. And those hollow types of drama and actions, they look good, I guess, if you're looking at a 10-second video clip or a soundbite for a news story. But do you really think that our Treasury Secretary getting up and walking out of remote remarks from the Russian finance minister is going to deter Vladimir Putin from doing something that he intends to do one bit? I don't think so. What will deter Putin? You know, sound energy policy that favors Republican democracies and domestic energy, right? And it doesn't feed into the balance of trade payment benefits that Russia now enjoys because of these self-induced energy scarcity policies. Obviously, providing arms to the Ukraine, taking substantive actions when it comes to true sanctions across all Russian banking, all Russian commodities and energy, not just subsets that really don't hurt us as much as we might be willing to endure. Those are the types of actions that ultimately will deter someone like Putin, not walking out of a meeting of a bunch of PhD economists and central bankers. Yeah, so as we come to the end of our time for episode 50, make sure that you're watching every step the public unions make and every move that big government, the federal government, makes. I guess I'm sounding like the police in every breath you take, which is what I'm going to wrap with. I saw a great documentary the past week. I think it was on Amazon, And the documentary was about the Police, the musical group The Police, done by the guitarist Andy Summers. And the title was Can't Stand Losing You, which, of course, was a classic Police song. If you like the band, or if you like alternative rock from that time, you'll like this documentary. I think Summers did an excellent job with it. But what was funny that I wanted to share with you in the documentary was towards the very end of it, Summers is really into photography. So he loves photography. He got into it when he was on tour with the Police years ago. He uses a handheld 35 millimeter and he just loves to shoot photography, mostly black and white. So when he's on tour, he walks about all these cities and all these routes across different cities, sometimes at night, sometimes during the day with his camera. And he's just taking pictures basically of everything. And he's accumulated quite an impressive collection or gallery of art when it comes to his photography. So at the end or toward the end of this documentary, they are filming Summers as he's doing this at night. And he's in some large Asian city. I don't know which city it was. It could have been Jakarta, could have been Seoul. I'm not sure where he was at. And he's walking through the streets at night and he's taking pictures of this and that like he typically does, which was pretty cool to see him sort of in his moment. And he's walking by a bar on this pedestrian street, and the door of the bar is open. And you can hear music coming out of the bar, and you can tell they're playing karaoke. Karaoke is in full mode inside this bar. And the guy who's on the microphone, the moment Andy Summers is walking by, he's belting out his version of Every Breath You Take. So the cameras are following Summers. He's walking down this street. He passes this bar. That song's playing. And he just stops dead in his tracks, turns around at the camera, and just starts smiling. So he's game. Andy Summers is game for this. And he walks into the bar with the camera crew. Now, when he walks in, he's nondescript. He's wearing a tassel cap. You really can't tell who he is or that, you know, he's the guitarist for the Police. So he's standing there. And sure enough, him and the guy who's on the mic, they start singing Every Breath You Take together. They're doing a duo rendition of this. Song concludes. Andy Summers takes off his cap. And everybody, the guy at the microphone, the people in the bar, they realize who it is that just sang the song with them. And they've got the biggest looks of surprise on their faces that you'll ever see in your life. Pretty cool ending to the documentary. We'll talk next week. Until then, be kind, stay positive, and think long term.